I've now talked about the False Claims Act at really great institutions. And every time that I start and I say, you know, there's this private cause of action for whistleblowers, nobody's ever heard of it before. Nobody. I mean, room full of PhD economists, you know, scholars of taxation, all of these fantastic people had never really heard of the False Claims Act.
Corporate fraud works best in the shadows, behind corporate walls. How does the government bring these wrongdoers to justice? Whistleblowers. These are the stories of those who risk their careers to shine a light on allegations of fraud. Today on Fraud in America.
Welcome to today's episode of Fraud in America. Today we're going to go down a different road. Yeah. We're going to venture into the academic world with a professor, Jedson Leader Luiz. He's an assistant professor at Boston University School of Business in the Department of Markets, Public Policy, and Law. He's an economist studying public economics, health economics, and political economy. He's very interested in fraud, specifically misreporting and overbilling in public expenditures, especially in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. He came to attention, at least on my radar screen recently. He penned an article that was picked up by MarketWatch, the title being "Trillions in Infrastructure Spending Could Mean Hundreds of Billions of Dollars in Fraud." Professor, welcome to today's show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeb.
So your topics that you dive into are right in line with what this show is about, right? This idea that there's a lot of money going out the door, and there's possibly a solution, maybe not the solution in all situations, but whistleblowers can play a key role in protecting those funds. Can you talk about why you are focusing in on this particular area in your studies?
I got really interested in the topic of fraud a number of years ago when I got asked to work with an anthropologist looking at World Bank expenditures. And so she actually had come across some data from a World Bank project where we believed that a lot of money had been stolen. And we ended up writing this paper about how to use statistical patterns in data to detect misreporting. And I was hooked. I've always thought that, you know, I love math, I love statistics, but I'm very interested in the real world. So that led me down this rabbit hole. And while I was at MIT, I realized that I was much more interested in looking at America than I was at looking at the developing world. In academic economics, the study of corruption and fraud usually takes place when we look at governments outside the United States. There are a lot of people who study the Brazilian government, the Indonesian government, these sort of big developing economies that have some amount of what we call state capacity. So they have, you know, a government that works, but still lots of problems and potential for corruption. And that's not the direction I went. I think that there is really important work to be done on the same topics, but looking at the United States.
Why does fraud in the United States pique your interest?
I'm American, and I've seen various ways throughout my life in which the government, struggles to do its job in all the best ways. And that's not unique to fraud and public expenditure. But I think that it's a civil obligation for those of us who are capable and interested in the way in which the U.S. government works to try to improve it.
And we spend a lot of time on this in this show. We talk about the False Claims Act and its incentives for people to step forward to highlight fraud happening behind corporate walls. I know you've spent some time looking at the False Claims Act. Can you talk about your research?
Definitely. So the False Claims Act was the subject of what's called my job market paper. That's the paper that I used when I was applying for professorships. You get one thing that you get branded as, and I was the False Claims Act guy. It's interesting. You know, I've now talked about the False Claims Act at Wharton, at Cornell, at the University of Michigan School of Public Policy, at really great institutions. And every time that I start and I say, you know, there's this private cause of action for whistleblowers, nobody's ever heard of it before. Nobody. I mean, room full of PhD economists and sometimes also lawyers or, you know, scholars of taxation, all of these fantastic people had never really heard of the False Claims Act. And indeed, I hadn't either until, you know, pretty late in my graduate career.
Why do you think the False Claims Act's not on the radar? Admittedly, when I graduated law school, focusing in on corporate fraud, it was barely on my radar too.
It's a great question. You know, after the DRA in, what was that, 2006, Jeb?
Yep, 2006, yep.
I think actually TAF, Taxpayers Against Fraud, had a big hand in shaping some of those provisions. And one of them was this information mechanism by which companies that receive a certain amount of federal funds are required to tell their employees about the False Claims Act. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Yep.
So, you know, that probably has increased the dissemination, but it's also the sort of thing where, you know, if you start at a big hospital chain, you're probably going through 3 or 4 days of of training on HIPAA and all of this stuff. And it's just hard to get at that sort of information out there. I do think that there's a role that the law firms have played in trying to recruit whistleblowers to tell people that it's an option, but I'm not sure. There are a lot of laws. There are a lot of laws and economists study a lot of them. I feel really lucky that I've been one of the first people that's been able to study this. I do want to nod that there are a few great scholars who've done that as well, notably Professor David Howard down at Emory School of Public Health has some really great work with Ian McCarthy also at Emory. And then another great guy is David Engstrom at Stanford Law School has been doing some work on it. But they kind of do different stuff than I do in terms of their questions. I got interested in whistleblowers as a potential mechanism for understanding or rooting out fraud. And looking at the various federal whistleblower programs, I found that there was some research that had been done on SEC whistleblowers, some research that had been done on IRS whistleblowers, and almost nothing at the time. This is back in 2017, 2018, that had been done on the False Claims Act. Now, within the last 4 years, we've seen a few academics start to take interest. It's always garnered some support from the legal profession who ask questions like, why is there standing or why is there a circuit split? But in terms of economists or other data-driven social scientists, there's been very little work done showing what are the effects of this act. And so in my paper, which is called Can Whistleblowers Root Out Public Expenditure Fraud? Evidence from Medicare, I look at a set of large case studies of these big types of fraud that whistleblowers, sometimes multiple whistleblowers at different times, came forward and said, hey, this is what's going on. To construct those case studies, I read through hundreds of Department of Justice press releases and picked the categories that were biggest. That is, they had the most dollar amounts of fraud, with the exception that I had to have some amount of data on it. And so I have access to data from Medicare on claims from Part A and B, that's inpatient and outpatient care for fee-for-service Medicare. And I kind of did a mapping. So I looked at these cases and I would say, what are the hypotheses we could draw about what would happen if this had any effect? Which meant hundreds of hours of learning how billing codes work, reading through complaints or settlement agreements from these False Claims Act cases, and then trying to map them and say, okay, the whistleblower said this was what was going wrong. What actually happened? And I can give you some examples of that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear some examples. This is fascinating.
Sure. So a good example is, I look into a lawsuit and try to figure out what does this mean for Medicare claims? And that's hard because I'm not a physician. But I spent a long time understanding how billing works in Medicare. And it's a complicated procedure. It's different for every different type of care. And then I would map from these lawsuits into the Medicare claims and say, okay, what are the types of billing codes and where would we find them? The Medicare data are huge. They're, the data that I have access to are every patient in the United States from 1999 through 2016. I just applied for data through 2019. But that's every dollar that Medicare has spent on fee-for-service Medicare. Fraud is a needle in a haystack problem, right? It's really difficult to figure out where to look. And that's why these lawsuit data were so valuable. Either way, I'll give you a more concrete example. Tenet Healthcare, if you remember this settlement. Yeah. Tenet Healthcare was sued for intentionally manipulating some of its cost reporting in order to have more of its patients labeled as outliers. So Medicare works as follows in hospitalization. You go into the hospital, and if you have Medicare, and this is true for other forms of insurance, but specifically for Medicare, they categorize your stay into what's called a diagnosis group, a DRG, and then the hospital gets a fixed amount of money based on that. And those amounts of money are adjusted geographically to make sure that hospitals in more expensive areas get a little bit more, but they don't get paid for what they do. They just get paid for the disease that they're treating. And this is intentional. And the reason is that if we paid them for everything they did, they would do everything that they possibly could, right? They do lots of unnecessary procedures. And so as a way of combating that, we have this prospective payment system where a hospital gets, okay, you got pneumonia, you get X dollars. And depending on the type of visit, it's usually in the low thousands for a hospital stay that the hospital gets. The issue is then that creates an incentive for them to get rid of expensive patients. So if they have a super expensive patient, well, then they're going to lose money on that. And so in order to combat that is building on top of the other problems that they've built, Medicare has this second system called outlier payments. And outlier payments work as follows. If a patient is really costly or stays a really long time, but usually it's really costly, based on the hospital's average costs over time and how other patients have been treated, Medicare will pay extra money, what's called an outlier payment. And that had been based on historic data. And Tenet figured out that if they kind of fudge the numbers or, you know, change the look at the formula closely and figure out how to report it in a certain way, they could have a lot of their patients labeled as these more expensive outliers. And by doing so, they got Medicare to pay them quite a lot of money. So a False Claims Act whistleblower came forward, sued. It also got picked up one day before the lawsuit by, I want to say, UBS Warburg. So it kind of went to the press at the same time. We have now this interesting event, which is what happens to outlier payments. So I went through, you know, 100% of the inpatient hospitalizations over time to look for these outlier payments. And you can just plot it on a graph. And there is one day, right when this happened, or 1 month, I should say, where it just plummets. So over the course of the next month, that month surrounding the lawsuit, we saw a big drop off that never recovered. And so outlier payments were strongly deterred by this whistleblower. And then I asked the question, how much money did this save the government? And that's a hard question, right? That's a counterfactual question.
Yeah.
A counterfactual question. That is where I'm asking a question, what would have happened in the absence of a whistleblower? How much money would the government have spent? And that's really complicated and it requires some assumptions. But more or less, I build an estimate of that counterfactual by looking at the trend that we saw in spending beforehand and the trend of other things that looked like it beforehand and match them up. And I estimate that the government saved tens of billions of dollars on just outlier payments over the following years.
Amazing. So tens of billions just on outlier fraud. Interesting.
That's right.
You know, this concept of deterrence is something we've been trying to get at for 30 something years, right? This idea that the case settles for X millions of dollars, but the concept that, you know, once these cases are announced, it puts the rest of the industry on notice that don't do what this company did. And that story is oftentimes lost in the individual settlement. That's a fascinating study you've been looking into.
Looking at this across different cases, that is between that and a few other case studies. I look at kind of four big case studies. I look at the outlier payments. I look at Community Health Systems, which is a big chain that got busted for admitting patients that didn't need hospital beds. Mm-hmm. I look at the Allergan Botox settlement, and I look at the kyphoplasty case. These four cases, they're not exactly single cases. They're really case studies. Each of these has multiple whistleblowers, multiple lawsuits associated with it. Together comprise $1.9 billion worth of settlements. Mm-hmm. Which is about 10% of the healthcare settlements we saw over that period. And I estimate that they brought between $18 and $19 billion of deterrence effects just over the first 5 years after they were settled. So about 10x.
These numbers are hard for people to wrap their minds around, right? So the concept of billions of dollars.
You know, a million seconds is 11 days, 11.6 days. And a billion seconds is 31 years.
Wow.
So that's how much bigger a billion is than a million.
You said something earlier that fraud is like a needle in a haystack problem. So I guess it kind of says the answer is in my question, but why are whistleblowers so important in identifying that needle in the haystack?
Fraud has this needle in a haystack problem for a number of reasons. I want to step back a second and try to talk about, you know, how fraud arises from an economics idea, right? So There is what an economist would call an information asymmetry. So what's the difference between fraud and corruption? We say corruption is abuse of power for personal gain. And fraud is actually the exploitation of information. So what makes all fraud cases similar to each other is this idea that someone is using or exploiting information that they have and someone else doesn't. And so the government is spending its money in various federal programs on more or less asking companies to do things for them. That's what a lot of the government does. We ask defense contractors to do things. We ask, you know, transportation contractors to do things. And in the case of healthcare, most hospitals aren't run by governments. They're run by corporations or, you know, small practices. in the case of doctor's offices and stuff like that. And the people who are building the government have a lot more information about what actually happened in that hospital room than the government ever will. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call an information asymmetry. The government doesn't really know what happens when you go to a hospital. They're not there looking. All they can do is they can rely on the claim that the hospital makes to the government, you know, against Medicare or in some cases Medicaid or, you know, Champus or whatever. So that means they have an opportunity, right? We think that crime arises out of a number of factors, and one of them is opportunity. And that opportunity is there when the government just can't know as much. And there isn't a really great way to fix that kind of at a base level because, you know, the government isn't going to be able to perfectly monitor all of its, you know, Medicare beneficiaries in hospital. That's really difficult. So one of the reasons I think the False Claims Act is so sound, so powerful, is that it provides incentive for the people who have the information, the other people that are in the room, to come forward and tell the government, hey, here's what's going on, right? So just from a pure economic theory perspective, it seems like it should work really well. It does work really well. And then there's this other needle in the haystack problem, which is, well, maybe the government can use patterns. And so we've seen a rise both in the federal government and some companies that it pays to kind of monitor and audit claims, trying to use more sophisticated tools, basically machine learning, to pick out claims that look suspicious. But it's a nascent field. And as far as I can tell, it's not working perfectly just yet.
So we are in the middle of a pandemic, hopefully ending soon, trillions of additional government dollars flowing out of the government coffers. But yet we haven't seen increase in, for example, additional resources going to the Department of Justice Civil Division to help man these False Claims Act cases that are coming in. We haven't seen some corrections to the False Claims Act to make it stronger that we thought should have happened by now. You know, in this whole increased government spending world right now, why are we not seeing the strengthening of anti-fraud laws that I believe this was the topic of your Market Watch, right? That with increased spending, there's going to be billions of additional dollars in fraud. Why do you think that's happening?
So you have two questions there. One is, you know, basically, do we think that there is additional fraud with all this additional spending? And the second is, why isn't it a priority? The question about increased fraud and increased spending, yeah, there's always going to be more fraud when you spend more money. You know, the U.S. is fortunate relative to other countries that I think fraud is in the low single-digit percentages of government expenditure, 1%, 5%, somewhere in there. I mean, it's hard to know. It's really hard to measure fraud, but that's, you know, a reasonable estimate that many people have come up with. The issue is 1% of $3.5 trillion is like a ton of money, right? Yeah. And let alone a few percent of that kind of money. So, you know, the opportunity is there. The incentive is there for people to commit the fraud. But you're right that there's been almost nothing. So the word fraud only appears 7 times, at least in the version of text I read for the most recent $1 trillion expenditure bill. This is 2,000 pages of text. They basically aren't talking about fraud. And when they do talk about fraud, it's super vague. They'll say the secretary shall take all measures to try to deter fraud. Great. It's vague. It's vague. And by being vague, it doesn't provide any sort of additional incentives or additional funding for anti-fraud. Now, a couple things. The first thing is that the False Claims Act works pretty well. It has big deterrence effects, and it works through the courts. And courts are cheap, more or less, right? Like, we have pretty good courts in the United States. There are costs associated with lawsuits that both the whistleblower bears, the Department of Justice bears, the court system bears, and the defendants bear. And we can't write those off. But they seem like they're relatively small relative to, you know, kind of these effects, both in terms of how much fraud costs and how much deterring fraud can save. So one argument I could see about why we didn't do anything about fraud in this act is, well, we have pretty good anti-fraud stuff going on already. And that's probably true, but the Department of Justice doesn't take every case that they could take. The Department of Justice, in fact, I think regularly receives information about potential avenues of fraud and does not have the capacity to go out and chase those down. Particularly when we're talking about criminal healthcare fraud, they just only have so many resources. And so with the new spending, which is on, you know, infrastructure largely defined, we're going to see some amount of fraud. And I think that there's now this reliance on the False Claims Act and the hope that the DOJ can manage all those cases, because you know, their desks are piled high with questions of whether or not they want to intervene, and they're very selective about their interventions. I FOIA'd the Department of Justice for information on all of their False Claims Act cases. This is back in early 2017 or so. So, you know, not the most recent data, but I have this data set of everything. And one of the things you can check is, you know, what percentage of cases that the Department of Justice intervened in are settled. That is some that the whistleblower won. And it's above 90%. I think it's above 95%. And the reason is not just because they do a good job. I mean, but it's also because they can pick the cases that they think they're going to win because they have so many cases to choose from. They're not joining a case unless it's kind of a slam dunk, right? Unless it's a great case. And so, you know, with the additional spending, we're seeing additional fraud. So we saw additional fraud in PUA, that's pandemic unemployment assistance. We saw additional fraud in PPP, that's the small business loans. I'm not an expert on PUA or PPP. There are some great scholars, but I looked at the research that's been done, and there is concerns that something like, you know, 10% of PPP loans may have been fraudulent, I think was the number. That's not 10% by dollars, that's 10% by loan. You know, that's it's not individuals. It's largely, much like with healthcare fraud, it's not one person going through over and over again, different people and saying, I'm going to get a little bit of money off the government. It's organized crime or it's profiteering corporations that realize that the government just isn't watching and that there's a buck to be made. And so we have to really worry about that. And so I would love to see, you know, if we're going to allocate trillions of dollars to making our country more robust, some of that money has got to go to the Department of Justice to make sure that the rest of it goes to the right place.
Amen. Amen. So Judson, what are you looking at next? You know, there's so much fraud. There's so many areas, especially in healthcare, where there's room for studying. What's on your radar screen now?
I've got a super exciting new project, medium stage project, where we received some funding from the National Institutes of Health to study the False Claims Act broadly. And one of the projects specifically is fraud in hospice care. So there have been a few dozen lawsuits against hospice providers for admitting patients who don't have medical necessity. So the Medicare hospice benefit is supposed to kick in if you're terminal, that is, a doctor certifies that you have less than 6 months to live, and hospice pays a daily rate. So the hospice program, you forego curative treatment for whatever is you're terminal with, and the government instead pays someone to do palliative care, pain management, visiting you, that sort of stuff. And the rate of that has changed over time, but it's in the 150 to 250 kind of range per day, per patient. And for-profit hospices arose and grew, recognizing that who qualifies as a terminal patient is kind of a fuzzy thing. So here's the real issue. For any given patient, it's not like the government comes after 6 months and pulls the plug on you and your benefits, right? It's that, you know, sometimes people don't die in 6 months. It's hard to diagnose who's going to die in 6 months. In fact, there is excellent economics literature from Amy Finkelstein in Science showing that we can't predict who's going to die in the next few months. Even with everything we see in the healthcare data, it's just not a great prediction to make. Doctors are probably better because they have more information than the data scientists do. But even so, there's noise there. And that's okay. So people can stay on hospice for a little bit longer. That's a compassionate choice that we've made. The issue is it leaves us open to potential for fraud. Because that companies can enroll patients who are not dying or certainly not dying within 6 months, and they can just keep them on. And it's really profitable to have a patient on for, you know, 6 months, a year and a half, and the patient doesn't die. And eventually the hospice might, I mean, the patient may die in the long run, or eventually the hospice may stop billing for that patient and just like send them back into the Medicare population. And so we've seen a rise in lawsuits alleging that hospice firms are enrolling patients with Alzheimer's and dementia into hospice. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's and dementia is a long disease. It has a long disease profile. It takes a really long time for it to ultimately end in death, although it does. And many patients have Alzheimer's and are not terminal. And determining what is terminal within an Alzheimer's prognosis is very difficult. And also, what's so scary about the situation is these patients are the most vulnerable. They're the least able to say, hey, this isn't right, because they're struggling with Alzheimer's and dementia. So we've seen a massive increase in the usage of hospice for Alzheimer's patients. I made a plot recently that just showed the raw rate And I think it's more than doubled over the last 15 years. Actually, I should say in the 15 years of my data, which are 1999 through 2016. So we saw this big rise through the 2000s so far of the use of hospice to treat Alzheimer's patients. And I'm sure some of that is medically justified, and we don't know exactly how much. But some of it's probably not, given that we have, you know, more than 50 lawsuits saying that these patients are going inappropriately. So there have been settlements. The first big one was in 2005, 2006 against Odyssey Hospice. But we see cases ongoing. There was this long legal battle by AseraCare, who got accused of this and then settled and then appealed. Or I think they got ruled against and then they appealed. And then eventually they settled for almost no money. I think it was in this year or late last year. So it's an ongoing question. And the questions that I'm asking in this project are two. The first is, you know, can we identify what this is costing the US government? Kind of, can we put a dollar amount on this? And then also, what's happening to these patients? Hospice is complicated. Unnecessary hospice is actually really complicated because I can't say off the bat that it necessarily harmed people. It's possible that these are marginal patients who don't, under technicality, qualify for hospice. And actually putting them in hospice could have been good for them. And then we need to ask the question, okay, it's good for them, but at what cost, right? Is this something we should pay for? And that the simple policy outcome of that might be, we need to extend hospice to 9 months or a year instead of 6 months. The other side of the coin is it's possible it's really hurting them. Going on hospice means foregoing curative treatment for whatever's killing you or whatever, you know. And so if these patients are not terminal and they're being falsely enrolled in hospices by for-profit profiteering companies, that could have real negative health consequences on them. And so I don't have a strong hypothesis about which direction that's going to lie. I think more work needs to be done to understand whether and how harmful this fraud is. But I think it's really fascinating. I think it's understudied right now.
This has been a fascinating conversation, Professor. I really appreciate you speaking with us today. I really appreciate you trying to put numbers to what we all know as being a huge problem for our country, especially when it comes to healthcare fraud. I would encourage people to go to our show notes. We're going to link to Jetson's article. We're also going to link to a 30-day daily blog post that we did called Fraud by the Numbers, where we, not economists, not MIT trained, but lowly lawyers, try to put numbers to some of the fraud that we're seeing. So that's Fraud by the Numbers, 30 days worth of blog posts that we did, kind of looking at some of these numbers. And then next week, you're going to make sure you join us because we're going to go back to our usual kind of walk down the False Claims Act and fraud world to discover how fraud is exposing a lot of people to possibly patient harm and certainly markets to fraud. So you want to make sure you join us next week. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeb, it was great. Thanks so much.
If you believe you've witnessed fraud against the government at your job or want to learn more about these important laws to combat fraud, visit fraudinamerica.com. On our website, you can find whistleblower lawyers, blogs from these expert attorneys, and more. You can also find a transcript of today's show, show notes, a way to contact our team, and a way to chip in to make sure we can keep bringing you the latest on fraud. This episode was edited and produced by Rachel Brooks, and our theme music is by Connor Chaos. A big thanks to our staff and researchers of Jeb White, James King, Emma Bass, Jackie DeMar, Kate Scanlon, Brian Markovitz, and Max Boltman. You can learn more about them at fraudinamerica.com/team. Fraud in America is a project of Taxpayers Against Fraud Education Fund.